Natalie Newell is the director and producer of the Science Moms documentary and host of the Parenthetical Science Podcast and the Science Enthusiast Podcast. She worked for a decade in the field of early childhood development or education before pursuing her interest in secular and skeptical activism. She'll be talking about, or her talk title is From Skepticism 101 to Science Moms. Please welcome Natalie Newell. Hi, and thank you to Emily for making the connection and inviting me here today. So it's awesome to be here and to see a student group run something like this. So thank you so much. So to start, if you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe. And in my case, I guess if you want to make a film about evidence-based parenting and maybe form a community of like-minded parents in the process, you must first take a crash course in skeptical thinking. And I'll get to that soon, but I felt like there was no better way to start this than with a Carl Sagan quote. So if that's the best way to start, apologies if it's all downhill from here, but thank you for hanging with me. I feel honored to have been asked to speak to you here today, but I'll admit to having that why me sort of moment when Emily asked me, because I typically attend events to show and answer questions about my Science Moms film. And when I'm not doing that, I'm interviewing people on my podcast, people who I find interesting and hilarious, intelligent, accomplished, and so it's kind of different for me to be the one who's asked to come and talk, but different in a totally wonderful way. I sat in a coffee shop the other day thinking about how I'd approach this talk. My boyfriend knew what I was working on, and he sent me a text that just said, "Right from the heart." So that's what this is going to be, my personal equivalent of what I try to get from people when I interview them. When I did the Science Enthusiast podcast, we did 75 episodes, and in each interview, I would start by asking people their origin story, whether it was their atheist origin story, their skeptic origin story, just whatever it was that brought them from, you know, point A to the point of, you know, sitting over the internet talking to me about themselves for the podcast. So I guess now this is kind of my turn. For the sake of this conference, my free thinker, atheist, skeptic, humanist, just whatever, origin story. What brought me from sitting in Professor Stuart Weiss's Irrational Behavior, which I fondly refer to now as Skepticism 101, course at Connecticut College, to deciding to make a film and seeing it through to completion. So I feel like part of me being here is to show you that anyone can do this. Have an idea, have a desire to contribute a new narrative or to add to an existing conversation. Because this is a personal story, there's a lot of I statements, but all of this is really even more about the people who have contributed to my story, to being here talking to you today. I recently did an interview for my friend Chris Johnson's A Better Life podcast. And in the conversation, Chris asked me about my experience growing up. He asked if I was brought up religious, if I enjoyed science from an early age. He asked the questions to kind of piece together that part of who I am today, doing work in science communication and the, you know, secular sphere. So it gave me a chance to kind of look back and reflect. And looking back, I realized that my Italian-American Catholic-ish, definitely-ish on the Catholic, they were raising me as a critical thinking humanist, like probably without any of us realizing it. I mean, if I went to my parents right now and said, "Hey, thanks for making me a humanist," they might just look at me like, okay. Like, they have no idea what I'm talking about, but they would probably then go Google humanism, just like the time I was going to a skeptics conference in the UK, and I told my mom about it, and she just very adorably told me that she Googled skepticism to, you know, figure out what it was. So my parents, my mom is this no-nonsense, super pro-vaccine, and so that will make sense with the Science Mom stuff, nurse. And my dad, he's the kind of guy who, growing up, he would have my younger sister and I go with him to volunteer at the Catholic Church soup kitchen, but not because we needed to do it because God, but just, you know, because humans. I've heard through, you know, all of the interviews I've done, so many deconversion stories, stories that left people, you know, without their families, as outsiders in their communities, sometimes even fearing for the safety of themselves and their loved ones. So when I'm asked to tell my story, my, you know, atheist origin story or whatever it is, I mean, there's not much to it. I went to Catholic school and Catholic church. I received a bunch of sacraments, including this one where I look like the child bride of Jesus. My mom is my real hero for this talk because I texted her like, hey, do you happen to have a picture of me from my first communion? And she took a picture of the picture within maybe 2 minutes of me asking. So I don't know how she found it that quickly, but this exists. And I realized this is going to just be behind me for a few minutes, which is like just sort of bizarre and hilarious. But I, you know, was a second grader eating transubstantiated Jesus. And I just, transubstantiation is such a good word that I just needed to throw in there somewhere. So my family, though, it felt like Catholicism was just part of our Italian-American heritage. Going to church, doing all this bizarre stuff, was just like a tradition. It was, you know, going to Holy Communion was a way less fun version of, like, you know, sitting around the table at Christmas Eve later, you know, drinking wine and eating homemade pasta, which is way better than stale Jesus crackers. So I never really felt like my parents were indoctrinating me, and looking back, I really do feel like they brought us to church because it was the, you know, right thing to do. And maybe they believed in it, maybe they wanted us to believe, but what matters to me is that it didn't matter to them when I ultimately realized I don't believe in any of this stuff. My mom and dad, they didn't make me a Catholic. They gave me the space to realize that I'm an atheist. And likely without them even trying, they made me a humanist. And so in allowing me to question and explore the idea of belief, my parents definitely contributed to my identity as a skeptic. And, I mean, I only hope that I will do the same as I raised my own two little guys. So skeptic and skepticism, those were words that entered my personal vernacular in the spring of 2004. So now we're away from child me and Connecticut College, where I went to school. So I took my first psychology course at Connecticut College with a professor who would later become my advisor and just influenced me in a great way there. But spring of 2004, I took my final course for my psychology major. Full disclosure, I didn't know that I was particularly interested in the topic of irrational behavior, but I knew I wanted to take, you know, another course with my best friend Ross, with the professor that we loved, who we call Professor Andy Warhol, to his face, too, because he really looks like Andy Warhol. We, as people, I think, are the accumulation of all of our life experiences, you know, the people, the moments, like constantly shaping our worldviews. You don't always realize it when it's happening, that, you know, this is one of the big moments in your life. But taking this particular course, you know, at 20 years old, was one of my big moments. It's where kind of the seeds of critical thinking really began to take root and grow. And tree metaphor, I worked for 7 years at a school called Bono Montessori School, so I feel like tree root metaphor is just coming to a lot of what I say. But college, though, in my opinion, is just the beginning as far as learning is concerned. Even the class that, you know, shaped so much of who I am, I don't think I realized the value until years after the fact. In high school, I was, you know, involved in so many clubs and school and kind of that, like, overachiever person. And then I got to college, and yeah, I undoubtedly learned a ton. But I also, you know, I wanted to make my college radio show and go see, you know, cool bands at the little dingy club, like, 5 minutes from the school, and, like, binge watch pre-Netflix era, like, horror movies and everything by John Waters. John Waters, I've got a reference to him again later. But after grad school, I finally had more time to read for pleasure, to explore interests, you know, beyond that which directly contributed to me, you know, getting a job and working, going to school. I read things like Why People Believe Weird Things, God Is Not Great, Flim Flam by James Randi. But then there was Carl Sagan. I was a self-identified atheist since very early in college, though I don't know that I would say I was ever a true believer in anything, but for me it was Carl Sagan and the beauty of his words, like that mixture of science and awe that crystallized for me the fact that the world is amazing as it is. Without the need for fairy tales to explain the wonder of nature or to, you know, govern our own lives. And so he said, beautifully, what's up here, that the world is so exquisite with so much love and moral depth that there is no reason to deceive ourselves with pretty stories for which there's little good evidence. Far better, it seems to me, in our vulnerability is to look death in the eye and be grateful every day for the brief but magnificent opportunity that life provides. So, you know, I mean, who can really say it better than that, but this one life, this brief time on the pale blue dot is all we have, so, you know, it's up to us to make it count. While I was, you know, falling in love with Carl Sagan, I was working in what ended up being a decade in the field of Montessori education. This is actually the school that now my children go to that I used to work at. I love Montessori as a model of education for the way that it just effortlessly encourages this inquisitive nature in children. You can go into one of these classrooms and you'll see young children experiencing the wonder associated with discovering something new every single day. As a teacher, I spent a solid amount of my time directly teaching the students, but even more time just helping them find answers and, you know, real answers, which are more complicated than just God did it or something, to the questions about, like, everything. The Montessori philosophy often refers to teachers as guides because that's what we're really doing. We're guiding children as they ask, answer, discover, and just repeat endlessly. There's a fearlessness in children. They have this courage to be who they are, to ask questions, and to explore the world around them. So I would see this energy, positivity, fearlessness in my young students. But then, both as a teacher and then later as I was the director of the school, I would see fear in their parents. On a recent recording of my Parenthetical Science podcast, my co-host Chad and I were talking about food and medicine and particularly childbirth, and Chad said that right now feels like the safest time to be a child, but the scariest time to be a parent. Dan Gardner covered this whole idea of risk and fear extensively in his book, Risk, the Science of Fear, and he said, we're the healthiest, wealthiest, and longest-lived people in history, and we're increasingly afraid. That's one of the greatest paradoxes of our time. And so one day, I found myself sitting across from a mom who told me, like, in all seriousness, that she hoped that we didn't serve goldfish crackers at the preschool because she said that she runs a goldfish-free household. Like, So, I mean, this was kind of, I was like, what? Because I don't even have a goldfish-free floor of my car. So, that's just me, no judgment on foods. But it's funny in a way because it felt and still kind of feels absurd to hear someone say something like goldfish-free household and to express this, like, kind of genuine fear over a, like, cheddar fish-shaped cracker. But so at this point, I was a mom myself, and I wondered, you know, hearing not just this particular sort of silly moment about goldfish, but hearing all the other, you know, bits and pieces of worry directed, you know, towards me or around me, I wondered if maybe there was something like I was missing. Was I not worrying enough about something. Like, was I not momming hard enough because I wasn't worried about some of this stuff? I couldn't really empathize with that particular mom on that very specific subject, but I could sympathize because she was scared of something. In this case, it was crackers, but maybe I was scared of not being scared enough. You know, fear, it's out there. And fear, it sells, yeah, that is a fetus in a tomato. That's, if you Google GMO in Google Images, that's one of them. And it's been saved on my computer for a while because I just use it any chance I can. It's so weird. But these are images that pop up pretty easily, and companies and organizations, they know how to wrap up parental fear in adorable packages. You know, like those Honest Company diapers, because for some reason, they're natural and better than the stuff that I bought on sale at the grocery store. But they use buzzwords to capture parents' hearts and capitalize on, you know, parents' innate desire to do all we can to ensure the health and well-being of our children. You know, things natural, organic, chemical-free, holistic, non-GMO, you know, stuff about toxins. Like, trying to be a rational-minded parent, it sometimes feels like you're adrift in this sea of weird pseudoscience. I think I conveyed it, hopefully, that I feel lucky to have the parents that I have. I mean, I always knew it, but I realized it even more once I was pregnant and my little kids were entering the world. I attended childbirth and breastfeeding classes before my older son Milo was born, and I remember afterwards thinking, like, I need to have a natural childbirth, I need to exclusively breastfeed, no pacifiers, I need to make my own baby food, just all this stuff, and like, just because, reasons. But I remember my mom reminding me that I was born by C-section, I was formula fed, and I, you know, turned out to be okay. And that the most important part of all of it was that I was, you know, healthy and thriving, so was my child. So there are a lot of expectations placed upon women when they become mothers, as if there's a right way to do things. Now, I'll spare my ramblings on all these subjects because we wouldn't have enough time to kind of dissect and dive into all the issues surrounding motherhood, guilt, and shame. But I'll say once again that I was lucky to have the support of people who reminded me that, you know, fed is best when it comes to a child, that maternal well-being matters, and, you know, to also remind and say that sometimes, like, parenting kind of sucks, too. Like, raising tiny humans is a whole thing, but it's also amazing. And these are just some of my favorite little people. Like, the one stuck behind the bed is my son Milo, and I walked in on him one morning to get him up, and he just was like that, and he looks at me, and he's just like, this happens sometimes. And so I feel like that is just all of us. Is it just happens sometimes? And I didn't, like, go get my phone and had it with me, so I didn't just make him sit and be like, I'm going to take a picture, I'll be right back. It was a good moment to have my phone with me. And then there's little Zeke and my niece Ivy. So the two boys of mine, I've got that awesome niece. So parenting these amazing little humans. In the early days, when you have a baby, it involves the basic yet extremely complex act of just keeping a tiny human alive. Eating, sleeping, like, it's their world, and we just have to work within what they want and need. And so you find ways to pass the time and keep yourself awake during those 2 a.m. feedings, and thank goodness for iPhones, just to keep busy. By the time Zeke was born, I kind of bailed on Facebook and a lot of social media because I just didn't really want to bother too much. But I kept Twitter. In those days, Donald Trump wasn't president, and it was way more pleasant to scroll through the newsfeed. But I kept it to, you know, follow some, like, news sources, follow some blogs, whatever. I was never a fan of mommy blogs, per se, but there was one parenting site that resonated with me and like really helped me through those late-night feedings. It was called Grounded Parents, and the name got me right away because it felt like maybe this is going to be a good one, just in that name. And it was also part of the Sketchit network of blogs and sites, and at that point, I was already just kind of an observer, if not active participant, in the skeptic sort of world. I started reading the blog, and I did feel like, you know, hey, there are other parents that are kind of like me, that feeling. And sometimes you just need to have that feeling that other people kind of get where you're coming from. I was still working at the school during that time, and once parents knew that I had two little children of my own, they would never shy away from giving me advice about, you know, whatever. There was a time that I had Milo with me. He was little, maybe a few months old, and he was crying, you know, like babies do. And a mom came up and, in all seriousness, told me that I should take him to a chiropractor. Yeah, and when you're the school principal, you can't just be like, what the hell? That was just a thing that happened. Or the mom who asked me if I was going to vaccinate and that maybe I should not. And again, I had to just look at her and say, thank you for sending your children to our school. So this was real life. But at least at this point, I did know that science-minded, rational parents existed somewhere, at least on the internet. So when I sat in that Skepticism 101 class back in college, I didn't know that it would bring me down this skeptical rabbit hole that kind of changed my life. But when I sat with Zeke at one of our 2 a.m. feedings, and I came across the Moms for GMOs letter on Grounded Parents, I think it was an almost literal eureka moment, but a quiet one because I didn't want to disturb him. For me, it was a moment of feeling like I finally found people who got it, who articulated the way that I felt when I saw Gwyneth Paltrow go to Washington, D.C. to speak about GMOs, you know, just from her point as a mom. Or, you know, the way I felt when I heard parents saying things like, take your kid to a chiropractor, or I hope your school only serves organic food, or, you know, whatever it was. These women, these moms for GMOs, they wrote a powerful letter coming at the issue of biotechnology as moms, sure, but also as scientists and science communicators. Reading the letter just made me pause and think, you know, why wasn't this a bigger, more visible part of the available parenting narrative? And since it's not, is there a way that I can help make it so? You know, is there a way to marry the facts with the feelings to convey the evidence-based ideas through stories from these articulate, amazing women? Because I'm not a scientist. Like, I wanted to share this message, but I didn't want to just get up there and appeal to my own momness. You know, I didn't want to be like Gwyneth Paltrow. I wanted to make kind of the anti-vaxxed film, you know, that it's a Andrew Wakefield anti-vax propaganda film, but I wanted to do kind of the opposite of that. I wanted to highlight critical thinking and use science and evidence to alleviate the fear that comes with, you know, raising tiny humans. So I made a movie. It's more complicated than that, of course. I didn't know what I was doing. This is me making a film. But I knew that I had an idea, and I was fortunate enough to have people in my life who knew what they were doing and who could advise me along the way. I mean, I'm lucky enough to, my kid's dad is an editor with National Geographic, so he gets huge credit for, you know, expertly editing this film, bringing the vision to life. The journey from inception to completion of the film was a life-changing one. And actually say that without any hyperbole. I mean, making science moms changed my life. And so, like I said, when I started writing this talk, I didn't know what it was going to be about. Like, my boyfriend who told me to write from the heart later followed up and said, you know, was I going to talk about the actual filmmaking process? And, I mean, contrary to what some people on Twitter think, the film wasn't funded by Monsanto. I don't have lots of shill bucks for making a GMO film, and the process of making the film couldn't really be much more grassroots. But I don't know if the filmmaking process is what matters here for the sake of the talk. What matters and what I want to convey is how worth it it is to, you know, take a leap, trust in your ideas, and surround yourself with people who believe in what you're trying to accomplish. So for me, it was this desire to contribute to the parenting narrative, to platform women whose voices I felt then, and I think now feel more than ever, need to be heard. And beyond all that, I think it was a desire to see if maybe there was a community that could be formed in all this. You know, maybe there were people outside of just our family and friends who cared what we had to say. I was taken aback by just how willing Allison Coven, who's here, thank you for coming, Anastasia, Layla, and Jenny were to trust in this vision that I, just, you know, some random person on the internet had. So I wanted to show you the trailer. It's 2 minutes just so you can kind of see what this is about. And
genetic engineering does not involve syringes with needles. It's just not how it works.
If you put into Google, what is a GMO? The first few Google results are bullshit. They're not science-based, they're not reputable sources, they're going to be websites that are sponsored by the organic industry to scare you about your food.
I can't imagine parents reaching for something that's untested, unregulated, and literally has no active ingredients in it. It just baffles me.
Someone is talking about a synthetic chemical and calling it a toxin. You know they don't know what they're talking about, and then you shouldn't listen to them anymore.
Nature will kill you really quickly.
There's some organizations that are trying to scare people away from buying certain fruits and vegetables. That's crazy to me.
The voices of moms who inform their decisions with fear and hype rather than evidence, those voices are so loud.
Don't understand this mindset that anyone who doesn't have the exact same worldview as you must be paid to have that worldview.
Conspiracy theories, accusations, I've been called a fake mom, I have gotten death threats.
Being a parent is scary. We're all trying to do the best for our kids. There are plants all over the world. They're going to be wiped out. And so there are real world consequences.
We could really change things for the better using this technology.
Science is so cool.
So, yeah, I mean, the process of making this film was amazing, and I think the process really showed me how, you know, this, the world is kind of full of pretty amazing people out there. So these are just some of my favorite pictures from over the past. Somebody wrote a blog post the Monsanto one is Monsanto Friends is one of my favorite internet things ever for putting our heads and taking the time to do that because we're all shills for Monsanto. But the process of making this was amazing, and it was so cool to see how we received support from all different groups of people. You know, the science communicators, skeptics, the agriculture world, atheists, humanists. Just to see how ideas can bridge tribes of people, and that, you know, maybe there's hope for us if we can connect through our commonalities. My hope for the film and the Skeptical Parenting podcast I'm doing now is that we can, you know, just help make parents worry less, feel less alone, and, you know, maybe in the process we can sow the seeds of critical thinking. I mean, whether it's science moms or secular activism, science communication, I don't necessarily think that it's about changing minds right in the moment. It's about starting conversations, starting someone down a path where maybe they have the courage to challenge their own deeply held beliefs. So my hope for, you know, anyone who has a passion, an idea, a goal they want to achieve, whether it's in secular activism or anywhere else, is that you, like, you make it happen. And I know that sounds like a motivational, like, platitude, or that would be hanging in an office or something, but I mean, I think to remember that there's a supportive community. Like, you're not alone in having an idea and wanting to make it happen. And I feel so lucky to be surrounded by the people in my orbit who were awesome. And when I would have moments of doubt, just be kind of like, get it together, Noel, in the most loving way possible. And I will also say that I was lucky in that regard. And if anybody has an idea that they want to see it at completion, like, for real, email me, find me on Twitter. I'll be your cheerleader in your projects. And I want to just end the me talking part of this with a quote from my favorite author, Tom Robbins. He's just an author I love so much. I even got a tattoo of the cover of one of his books. I know that, like, some religious people probably go to Bible verses when they want to feel inspired. I just go to Tom Robbins' Goodreads, like, favorite quotes page, like, from time to time, just to remind myself of things. And so that's why I want to kind of go here. And he said, "Our lives are not as limited as we think they are. The world is a wonderfully weird place. Consensual reality is significantly flawed. No institution can be trusted, but love does work. All things are possible, and we can be happy and fulfilled if only we have the guts to be truly free and the wisdom to shrink our egos and quit taking ourselves so damn seriously." But John Waters also said that, so I think that's a good, like, life motto, too. Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I wanted to ask, it seems to me that parenting is one of the most complicated and interesting and unpredictable jobs that a person can have. And why, I mean, other than the advent of the internet and being able to find bad information, why would such a large majority of our culture, that was, again, from my perception, choose to make an already complicated and interesting job even more complicated and fanatical and conspiracy theory driven? Why is that so prevalent in the parenting culture?
I don't know, but I think, you know, you did hit on the fact that right now with the internet, information is so readily available that with parenting with kids, you want to do whatever you think is best, but sometimes it's hard to remember that there's not one right way to do it, and there's just so much out there that, I mean, I don't know, it's like this information overload, and it does seem like people are making it more complicated, when in reality, like, in the film, Jenny, one of the women, she, like, boils it down to everything that, like, you need to know to just, like, write on a half sheet of paper, like, basic, keeping your children healthy and safe and all of that. But I don't know if it's the desire to be the best or do it better, but I don't know what metric people are measuring that by, but with the, you know, age of the internet, people are wanting to go back to this, like, natural, antiquated view of things, so it's all kind of mixed up, and I wish I had the answer, and if I had the answer, I would have to make this movie and have this talk, because I kind of wish this movie didn't have to exist to, you know, debunk some of this information.
So have you heard the term baby scientist?
Baby scientist? No.
Yeah. Allison Gopnik is a researcher, I think she's at Berkeley, and publishes articles in newspapers and magazines for general science readership. And she, one of the things she reports is that babies will react more strongly to an unexpected event in their environment than one that they might know about. So here's an example. They put a device on a baby so they can do eye tracking. That allows you to see what a six-month-old or a one-month-old is paying attention to. And then imagine a scene where a ball is rolling off a table and falling. And then if the ball keeps on going, the baby will spend much more time looking at the ball that keeps on going because it's unexpected. They're at an age where they're learning about gravity and moving their body in three-dimensional space. This is just one example of how we come into the world already with many behaviors that are truly remarkable at very young ages. For instance, you can see empathy in very young infants. So that sort of connects with secularism in the sense that our ethical and moral system is well formed in a amazingly deep way, even though we're very, very young. And we don't need to learn the golden rule from a religion, for instance. But I thought you'd be interested in the science connection, baby scientists. So Alison Gopnik is a good person to seek out.
Yeah, I learned something new today. Every day is a school day.
I'm hoping you can tell us a story about a parent who got a hold of you having seen this movie and said, "You saved my children's life."
Oh, I wish that I had one of those stories and I was a true hero. No, but I will tell you though, I have had an experience where, like, just simply realizing the power of simple conversations with people. A mom asked me, like, you know, just on the playground, "What do you do?" And I told her, "Well, right now I'm making a film." I told her what it was about. And she said that she was considering not vaccinating her children. Her husband wanted to. She didn't want to. She didn't know what to do. And I didn't tell her, like, "Listen to me." I just said, why don't you ask your doctor and get an evidence-based perspective? They're not as scary as you think they are. And then a month or so later, I saw her at another school event, and she said that her kids got their vaccines. So, you know, just those parent-to-parent, finding common ground conversations, didn't save anybody's life. But, it helps to just have those conversations, whether it's about these topics or, probably the conversations you guys can have on campus.
Any other questions? All right, we will take a break then. One more class.